But for us, what built the mystique and the cult following and all that, and the sort of legendary status that people have bestowed on us, is that, you know, there was an effort to listen to our show and to record it, because if you wanted to hear the best hip hop available in the world, you basically had to wait a full week for a 4-hour program that you might have fell asleep on, or you might have only, you know, recorded half of which because you ran out of cassettes, or so. Yeah, it was a different mindset.
Hello and welcome to the Ear Fuel Podcast. As always, I'm Joel Freemark, and you can follow me on Twitter at GetEarFuel and at The Daily Guru. The podcast is always available at soundcloud.com/GetEarFuel and in the iTunes and Google Play stores under Ear Fuel. What you heard at the top was part of my interview with DJ, filmmaker, and all-around amazingly creative icon Bobbito Garcia. We talked about everything from the changes in radio over the years and how that's impacting the industry, to how visual art played a key role in the development of hip-hop, and just, we talked for about everything. It was awesome. And we will get to that interview right after a very quick album review. The album I want to check out today is the debut from the collaborative project between Les Claypool and Sean Lennon, and they're teaming up under the name Claypool Lennon Delirium. This record is called Monolith of Phobos, and it was far different than my expectations going into it. See, it's just the two of them on each track. Les is playing bass, and Sean is handling drums and guitar, and they share vocals. Well, they kind of share vocals. I mean, this record has some issues. It really does. But before we dig into that, I don't agree with how people are labeling this record. A lot of people I see, they're calling it experimental. And if you're familiar with what experimental music really is at its core, this is miles from that. And I understand I might be splitting hairs here, but I would accurately describe this record, in a good way, as adventurous psychedelic funk, and when they lock into that sound, it's a damn good sound. This record actually runs the gamut for me, as there's parts on it that I really, really, really love, and then there's a number of them that are just total snooze fests, and I think this comes from one core reality that I suppose I should have considered a little bit more heavily going into things. As much as I'd hoped it would be, this is far from a 50-50 split in terms of collaboration. The majority of these songs sound like, I mean, they're very heavy Primus-style songs with some light touches here and there from Sean Lennon. It's not necessarily a bad thing, but it certainly colors this record in a very specific light. Tracks like Breath of a Salesman and Captain Lariat are just a bit too far to the Primus end of the spectrum for me to really enjoy what's supposed to be a collaboration, and for the record, I love Primus. That's one of my all-time, like, top 20 favorite bands. But when I'm thinking of something that's a collaborative record, it's not really what I'm looking for. Now, they do get closer to that idea with Bubbles Burst in America. You know, in those moments, you get a glimpse of how great that could be. Well, you know, it's more like a taste, because the song Boomerang Baby, absolutely perfect. It's got phenomenal orchestrations and just the right touch of darkness to it. The flow here is fantastic, and eventually you get keys on this song. They are magical. This song, that is what they should have been aiming for all around, because it's so damn good. The two-part song, Cricket and the Genie, definitely good as well, and you get a nice touch there of some metal-style fuzz and almost a Pink Floyd-y bass tone, and I say that again, in a good way. There aren't any outright bad songs anywhere here, but I found myself wondering at a number of times where exactly Sean Lennon's contributions were on certain songs. I mean, I get that he took a backseat here, as often happens with Claypool's long list of collaborative projects, but I really wish that he would have found more shared space, because that is when this record is at its best. The lyrics here are mostly forgettable, but the music itself is more than worth checking out. While there's a number of tracks that you'll just hear once and move on from, there is some really good stuff here that shows promise of something far greater, and I have a feeling the live shows are where these songs are going to really, really shine. So, yeah, if you're into either artist, or you just want to hear some wildly exploratory soundscapes with touches of everything from funkadelic to Ween to the Beatles, go put your ears on this album. Moving on, when it comes to massively important figures in the progression of hip-hop music, Bobbito Garcia is way up there on the list. Among a long list of projects, he was one half of the legendary Stretch Armstrong and Bobbito Garcia radio show, which ran for nearly a decade on WKCR in New York City. The show is famous for featuring then unsigned, if not unknown, acts like Nas, Notorious B.I.G., Jay-Z, DMX, and countless others. It was so unique, this radio show, that it had a true cult following, with people trading taped recordings of the shows, and even to this day, there are message boards out there where people are trying to complete collections and get specific performances. This radio show really existed like no other, and for nearly a decade, it was the only place to go if you wanted to know the best in hip-hop. He's also a killer DJ. He's turned me on to so much great music over the years. He's written books on sneaker culture, directed films. He runs a worldwide basketball tournament. The man just does it all, and he does it all to the highest standard. The other day, he and I met up on a basketball court in a park in Manhattan to talk about changes in music culture, the permanence of art, his own influences, and a ton more. So sit back, relax, and enjoy a conversation with one of my favorite people on the planet. Man, this was a perfect idea. Like, exactly what we're looking for. So let's start at the beginning. How did you kind of come into music? Because you have such a wide range of love and passion for music.
Yeah.
Where did that begin?
Well, that's a loaded question. My first influence would probably be my sister, who was into disco, jazz, R&B. Not the R&B we hear now, pop radio, like rhythm and blues.
Like real, what it was started as.
For the 60s and 70s. And she used to listen to WBLS every day. Uh-huh. And at 8 o'clock, they used to play There I Go, There I Go, There mm-hmm. I Go, Moody's Blues.
Yeah.
And we'd sing it in the morning. I think it was Ken Spider Webb. And, you know, we just listened to all that great music of the 70s together. And she used to buy records. The first 7-inch I ever purchased was with her.
Do you remember what it was?
Of course I do. I still own it. It was a Gil Scott-Heron cover of The Bottle.
Yeah.
By the band Brother to Brother.
Nice.
On Turbo Records, the Salmon label. And that was the start of it. But my dad was a Latin jazz musician.
Uh-huh.
And he opened up with Tito Puente at the Palladium back in the 50s. We had Tito's vibes. They were a gift from the legend himself in our living room. And so he was playing a wide variety of music as well. Much of which I deflected as a kid.
Of course you do.
I was a kid.
Yeah.
I had no idea that Jumbo Silva was a Latin jazz legend, you know, in our household all the time, jamming. Until much later, I was like, wow, Jumbo was a legend.
Sure.
No idea, you know. So that's the beginnings of the love for music. You know, it's right there. And I took piano lessons for 10 years from age 6 until 16. Yeah, my mother will tell you that I started at age 3, but yeah, I don't recall that.
That was more just like banging
that
on the
keys. That might be my older siblings.
Sure, sure. And so how did kind of hip-hop start coming into the picture?
Well, that started really with art and appreciating the pieces that were up on the trains as a kid. And not realizing then, because I had no semblance of art history, but there was something mysterious about art in motion.
Okay.
And also the non-permanence of art. So, you know, I was by no means artistically inclined, and I can't tell you who the greatest writers of the period were, but I can tell you that being on the train station on 96th Street, waiting for the 2 to go to the Bronx, and that train car rolled in, there were days where you would just miss your train just so you could stay on the platform to wait for the doors to close so you could see the whole piece top to bottom and then watch it go away and to know that you may never see it again.
Sure.
That's interesting. I mean, because most art that we've seen has, most great art that we know of is pretty permanent. It's collected, it's preserved in museums, and, you know, what was going on in the 70s was just very dynamic. So that's my first introduction to hip-hop.
Mm-hmm.
Then after that, it would have to be the original rocker, Crazy Craig, who was a member of Zulu Nation.
Uh-huh.
And he put me down, introduced me to Ramen, to B-boying. This is 1977.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, I lived across the street from Rock City Park.
There you go.
Yeah. just had to be, that just happened to be in the right place at the right time.
Sure, sure.
Not that I was a breaker, but, you know, Ken Swift was a childhood friend, and he was, you know, him and Legs were like the baddest of the crew. And so right there, it's like, you know, Ken Swift becomes this legendary all-time B-boy of B-boys. And, you know, I know him as Ken. We used to play football together when we were 11 years old. So, you know, and then Legs and I became very close friends in the 90s when I started on a radio show with Stretch. And at that point, now I'm no longer the sort of like passive hip-hop participant. Now I become very active and a public figure via the WKCR Stretch and Bobbito radio program that we did for 8 years. Until 1998.
How did that come around? Like, how did you end up in that position?
Well, I would encourage everyone to watch the film, Stretch and Bobbito Radio,
the film,
that changed
huh?
lives, that I directed and co-produced and wrote.
I saw it. I loved it.
Thank you. I appreciate
that. It was
fantastic,
man.
Stretch, my former radio partner, was also the music supervisor and co-producer of the film.
Uh-huh.
And it premiered on Showtime. It's available on iTunes, Vimeo, YouTube. You can download, stream, rent it. Or watch it on Showtime On Demand, Showtime Anytime, Showtime Online, or the channel itself. And we'll have other platforms that we'll be joining as well pretty soon. And the film documents the whole narrative of me and Stretch, how we meet, how we became these unlikely hip-hop heroes of the 90s, and how we really led a unique community of listeners who were cult-like and their following.
Yeah, absolutely.
And also how we helped create a platform for 300 unsigned artists over an eight-year period who to date have sold in excess of 300 million records. And the film, you know, does an honest portrait of all that and some of the negative things that happened along the way as well. So, yeah, stretchandbobbito.com to check out all the formats that's available on. We have a DVD. We have a DVD box set that includes three digitally remastered archive radio cassettes.
The old cassettes.
Yes. See, along with the DVD. We think about releasing a film on VHS. And that could still happen.
I love it.
Who would do that?
You know, but I think that's one of the most unique things about the show was that, you know, the cult around just collecting those tapes.
Yeah.
And, you know, like that when the internet came around, people were trying to hunt them down and search for the shows they didn't have and stuff. You really don't see that.
They still hunt them down.
Yeah.
We still get hit up like, yo, what was that record you played at 3:59 on May 28th, 1997? Sorry, dude. I don't remember.
Oh, nice.
But, you know, we were fortunate. Mm-hmm. I say we were fortunate in that not everybody that knew about our show could hear it.
Uh-huh.
And so it's opposite to today's accessibility.
Sure.
If you learn about a record, pretty much you can find it. And that's a great thing, too. That has its properties that are positive.
Mm-hmm.
But for us, what built a mystique and the cult following and all that and the sort of legendary status that people have bestowed on us is that, you know, there was an effort to listen to our show and to record it because if you wanted to hear the best hip-hop available in the world, you basically had to wait a full week for a four-hour program that you might have fell asleep on, or you might have only, you know, recorded half of which because you ran out of cassettes. Or so, yeah, it was a different mindset. Yeah. You know?
Do you think that now that we are in this culture of accessibility with music, that it's kind of changing how musicians operate and how artists approach things?
Oh, absolutely.
Do you think it's for the better? Or for, you know,
it's for the listener to decide. For me, I appreciate. I mean, you know, you produced my East Village Radio program for a year. I only play vinyl. It's not that I prefer. I mean, it's unequivocally the best sound that you could. It's the best replication of an original recording.
No arguments here.
Yeah, no argument there. Right. So, yeah. And I like to listen to analog cassettes as well. You know, and you know, the accessibility of music in this day and age it's an interesting dynamic and is deep because, for example, there's not a lot of artists who actually have record sales. There's a lot of streaming. There's a lot of downloading.
Sure.
There's a lot of illegal uploads. I mean, you know, bootlegging happened back in the 90s as well. And, you know, if you want to impress a woman that you were going on a date with, maybe you gave her a cassette of your favorite album
sure.
that was a dub that you didn't buy. So it's not like, you know, it's not like every, you know, package of music back then was bought either. But
right.
it definitely seems a lot easier for people to hear music without the artist getting paid for it. And, you know, if the artist isn't receiving funds to promote them continuing making great music that may not be necessarily commercially viable or, you know, just counterculture, then that you know, it becomes hard for them to subsist. And some of them make the decision to make music less creative, or, you know, they compromise their means.
Mm-hmm.
And what you wind up with is less memorable music.
Mediocre
and,
stuff.
And that's not to say that there's still amazing music being made today. Uh-huh. Phenomenal music being made today. But, you know, quite honestly, like, you know, even with great headphones, and people like, oh, yo, listen to this. And it's like, you listen to something off a laptop, it's just like, it's all compressed. And
yeah.
It just doesn't, you know, I don't know. I feel sorry for people, quite honestly. Yeah, people listen to stuff in restaurants with, like, these tinny speakers.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like they're playing compressed MP3 files, and it just sounds so, there's no warmth, there's no emotion. And it's like, you know, people will rebuy Fela Kuti's entire collection, or John Coltrane's entire collection, or Stevie Wonder's entire collection. And it's great for the record industry because it's like, oh, okay, we've just sold the same compositions on a fourth format. We originally sold it on vinyl and then convinced people to buy it on cassette and then CD and now digital. So, that, you know, one person is in their lifetime, if they're in their 60s, has probably bought the same album four times.
Sure.
And yet, the form that they're getting it on at this point is the lowest form that they could possibly.
Yeah.
Unless you're an audiophile and you're really, like, you're buying, like, the high profile, like, master and dynamic headphones or.
But the source is still not great if it's a digital copy.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. It can. I mean, you know, some people have nice speakers and.
Yeah.
You know, but I'm sure the other point is that so music is being made now for digital mastering.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of, you know, the mastering for vinyl, that so the range on the sound meter is going to be different. I mean, just everything is different, man. I feel sorry for people. I feel sad. And then, you know, people's attention span is just SH asterisk T now. So, yeah, if a kid has an iPad or iPod,
sure,
and he's got like 10,000 songs on it, more than likely he's gonna, you know, switch from song to song in a matter of a verse. And so, you know, I don't know that the majority of people listening to music have the attention and the patience. And I don't know that the artists are making the 12-minute song knowing that, like, there's... I mean, even DJs now, you know, mm-hmm. let's talk about the clubs. You know, they're flipping records, like, real quick.
Yeah.
You know, some of these artists didn't compose an 8-minute song to only be heard for 2 minutes. Now, of course, you have DJ style and the DJ creating their own composition with the records or mm-hmm. the, you know, the files in their laptop. But ultimately, you know, to me, you got to pay respect to the artist on some level, and you got to challenge your dance audience. So
we kind of just touched on kind of why, you know, the negative implications of current music.
Yeah.
What's turning you on these days musically? Like what new stuff have you been getting into?
Yeah. I mean, this, you know, I buy vinyl. I mostly support a store in Amsterdam called Rush Hour.
It's a good one.
Yeah, it is a good one. And I find a lot of UK and European, Japanese releases there that mm-hmm. are not available in the United States. And I'm constantly buying new 7 inches and 12 inches. I'm horrible for telling you what they are because I can't remember. But I can tell you this. I mean, there's some labels. Soundway, True Thoughts, Gam out of Sweden. Soundway and True Thoughts out of the UK. Record Kicks out of Italy.
Mm-hmm.
Daptones out of New York.
Of course.
I mean, these are all consistent. You know, sometimes you could just close your eyes and be like, yeah, you know, I'll get the next three releases on this label. Uh-huh. Quantic is phenomenally gifted at anything he does, you know, Latin music, electronic, hip hop, dance.
Mm-hmm.
He's definitely one of my favorite producers. You know, Eddie Palmieri, who I just opened for 2 weeks ago at Red Bull Music Academy concert series in Harlem.
Yeah.
He revisited his Harlem River Drive 1971 nice. Album, which he hadn't performed live in 45 years.
Nice.
And, you know, the dude is going to be 80 this year. He is still as prolific a composer and performer as he has ever been. He's been recording since the 1950s. So, you know, props to Eddie. He did three original compositions for my first film, Doing in the Park, Pick Up Basketball NYC, which was co-directed by Kevin Coolio. And, you know, we were graced by his presence. And the way he interpreted our film with his piano chords is just insane.
So what has brought you into film?
Well, I've been fortunate, Joel, in that I published a book.
Yep.
I also was the editor in chief and co-founder of a basketball magazine. I've been on camera, 40 commercials, 10 feature films. Did a radio show, Landmark One, with Stretch in the 90s.
Uh-huh.
Traveled the world, you know. Played professional basketball, did halftime performances for the Knicks and halftime reporter for the Knicks on MSG Network. I mean, I've done a lot of crazy things in my life. And I really felt like film was like the last frontier as far as getting behind the camera.
Uh-huh.
So my first film, Doing the Park, Pick Up Basketball NYC, was co-directed by myself and Kevin Coolio, who was also director of photography. And we had such a ball doing it. We did this crazy concept of going to 175 courts in 80 days throughout the five boroughs back in 2010. And, you know, we had the time of our life. You know, I'm speechless. I mean, well, luckily it's documented in the film.
Sure.
But we experienced so much making that film. And so when that was in the can and it premiered on PBS and had screened in six continents and won a bunch of awards at festivals and everything, I got approached by a producer by the name of Omar Costa, and he asked me to consider him for my next project. I didn't have a project in mind. I just had a child. I was like, all right, I ain't doing another film.
Yeah.
And he was like, yo, I used to listen to you and Stretch. And then the light bulb went in my head. Ding. Ah!
There it is.
And then we embarked on a mission. We made the film in 18 months.
Wow.
And it premiered in the fall of 2015 on the very month of the 25th anniversary of the start of me and Stretch's radio show back in 1990. And it's been a joyride since. You know, Stretch and I have traveled to Dubai, Milan, Bologna, Paris, London, Berlin, you know, on and on. L.A., Atlanta, for the premieres in all these cities.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've been booked to DJ afterwards and do Q&As. And so it's been an unbelievable ride. You know, both films exceeded expectation in terms of, you know, where they've landed and been seen. Yeah, for sure. I'm working on a third film.
Oh?
Yeah, it's untitled, but it will be an autobiographical documentary of my life in basketball, nice. Sneakers, and music. It's just in pre-production now, just
sure.
pulling together archives and stuff. Yeah.
So now we know that's what's next.
That is what's next.
One of the things that are coming
next. One of the
next.
Things is next. Well, I also produce an international basketball tournament called Full Court 21.
Uh-huh.
It's played in 15 cities over four continents, and all the winners are invited to play in New York at the All World Final this summer on August 23rd at the legendary Goat Park on 99th in Amsterdam. And for all information about this shameless promotion that
it's
I'm providing all of you,
go for it,
Joel listeners out there, go to coolboblove.com, spelled with a K, or fullcourt21nyc.com, or stretchandbobbito.com, or doingitinthepark.com, and that's spelled without a G. Joel, it's been great being on your show.
Man, I am so glad we finally made this happen.
Have
man.
I talked your headphones off?
Man, we could talk forever.
We could talk
this.
Forever.
We know
yeah.
this. You know. It's just people who, you know, we don't know how to sit still. Like when people are like, just take a couple months off. It's like, what?
Nah, what? What?
What do you mean?
What do you mean?
What do you mean? I took last night off when I went to sleep. And now I'm back up, so I got more to do.
That's like, reminds me of the Nas line. I never sleep, because sleep is the cousin of death.
Exactly. Mm. Well, thank you, my friend.
No doubt, my man. Good luck, all right?
All right.
Cool.
My thanks again to Bobbito Garcia for making time to chat with me. He is all over the internet at coolboblove.com. That's spelled with a K, not a C. On Twitter, Instagram, and all that stuff, at coolboblove. And of course, all the links he dropped in the interview. The guy never stops and is always a great time, so go get into it. Before we call it a week, though, I do, of course, have your weekly Ear Fuel listening assignment. For those of you new to the podcast, each week I assign an album to listen to in full, beginning to end, without any distractions or interruptions. It stems from the idea that these days music has been largely relegated to a background task. It's kind of like what Bobby Doe and I touched on for a bit there. You're driving, you're at work, you're at the gym, or whatever you're doing, and this assignment is about consciously listening to music for the sake of music alone and listening to an album from beginning to end. So this week, since he had a truly iconic performance on the Stretch and Bobito show back in the day, your listening assignment is one of my all-time favorite records, Notorious B.I.G.'s magnificent 1994 album, Ready to Die. Before we get into the music here, this record actually falls into that albums that almost never happen category. See, a few tracks had been recorded for Uptown Records when that label's A&R man, Sean Combs, was fired. Biggie ended up in this sort of limbo as the label didn't really have much interest in him, so he spent time allegedly selling drugs in North Carolina. Now, many months later, Combs, who was now calling himself Puff Daddy, launched Bad Boy Records, and he quickly brought Biggie back to finish the album. The tracks from those original sessions actually made it onto this record, and you can hear the difference in his rhyming style and the overall sound. Things Done Changed and Gimme the Loot were both from the earlier sessions, and when you compare the sound there to songs like Warning or The What, it's pretty obvious. Not in a bad way, but that's why those tracks sound different. Now, it goes without saying that the beats and samples on every track are outstanding. Trust me, they are. They have diversity in every way possible, and it's that reality that shows just why Notorious B.I.G. is considered by many, myself included, to be the greatest MC of all time. Regardless of the pace, the style, the flow, the whatever, he rips into every beat and rhymes brilliantly. He rhymes within rhymes, and he works off the beat whenever he felt like it. It's just the way he works around and through the beats and just kind of pushes things around that makes his rhymes so damn smooth. That's the key to everything he does. It's just smooth. And he could write about damn near anything. On this record, you get the classic Big Papa, but to me, it's actually one of the weaker moments on the album. From the life stories within Juicy and Gimme the Loot, to the perfectly gangster tracks like Things Done Changed and Me and My Bitch, to the brutal closing track, this record hits every emotion dead on every time. He paints these amazingly vivid stories, and you can almost smell the street and you can hear the sirens as he's rhyming. You've also got the classic Method Man duet on The What, and yeah, you know what? There is not a bad second anywhere on this record. Nearly every song is filled with quotes that have been ripped by the biggest selling rapper since, and you can really see this album as the blueprint for the dominance of the genre in the mainstream over the years, really. There's just this density within his writing and how he works that few other MCs have even been able to get close to, let alone match. Biggie can be dark and dangerous as easily as he can spin a hilarious story, and it's really the way he works the microphone that shows his true gift. Look, Ready to Die is just one of those records you have to experience to understand the genius behind, and even after more than 20 years, there isn't any rap album that I enjoy more than this one. If you don't know it by heart already, you need to change that right now. Thank me later. So that's all for this week. My thanks again to Bobito Garcia for stopping by, and you can always hit me on Twitter at @GetEarFuel and at The Daily Guru. The podcast is in the iTunes and Google Play stores under EarFuel and at soundcloud.com/GetEarFuel. And hey, if you dug what we're doing here, go tell a friend or three. That is your weekly EarFuel. Share and enjoy.